It is 8:10 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Do want to invite you to tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. Two guests for the 10:30 a.m. show, members of Congress from Minnesota, Democrat Betty McCollum, who's on the House Appropriations Committee, and also Republican Congressman Tom Emmer, who has a very senior position with the NRCC, the National Republican Congressional Committee. He is actually the chair of that committee. He's a very influential post within the Republican Party. And we'll be talking about the shutdown, because it was yesterday that the president said that this shutdown could last months, even years. With us right now, the one and only Professor Stephen Scheer, retired from Carleton College, but still very much writing and very much active in terms of political analysis. Steve Scheer, months, years? I mean, what is going on?
Well, first of all, I think we have to say that our president has a tendency to exaggerate.
Right.
And this is a long-standing tendency. I'm writing a chapter about his career as a celebrity, and oh my, this goes way back, Esme. So
yes.
When he says years, I think that is frankly impossible. Let's think about the actual consequences of the shutdown. On January 11th, all those government employees who are working because they are vital and can't be laid off will not get a paycheck. At the end of the month, food stamps will run out of money. When you look at those sorts of problems, I think that really does encourage some sort of agreement sooner rather than years later.
Right. Well, the interesting thing about this is that the president seemed to be on board for a compromise. This is, in sort of mid-December, to keep, do a stopgap measure. And everybody seemed to think he would do it. And he got backlash from his base.
Right.
And he drew the hard line in the sand. And then you had that infamous meeting with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in the Oval Office that all went down on videotape. and Pelosi, I thought, was almost masterful in attempting to goad him into, taking ownership of the shutdown. And he said famously, I'll be proud to shut down the government over border security. It seems like he's drawn a firm line in the sand. Mitch McConnell saying, I'm not even going to talk about this because it's, the president's not on board. I mean, how long can this go?
Well, as you said, the Senate passed a stopgap funding measure that would have funded the government until February 8th. And it looked as if the president was going to sign it, and then boom, he's not going to sign it. And then he's had his public histrionic since then. Mitch McConnell said, I am not doing anything until I get a sign off from the president before we begin in the Senate. So it all depends on what can be done between the new Democratic leaders and Trump. Now, one thing the Trump White House is actually enjoying in all this, Esme, is that they're really raining on the Democrats' parade. That is, you have a new Democratic majority in the House. They passed the governmental ethics legislation. They passed the short-term spending proposal. But all that tends to fade next to the high drama of the shutdown. And in part, I think Trump and his White House likes that. But as you suggested, the longer this goes on, the more the real consequences mount, and it's going to be a real problem for the president.
Right. And obviously, the concerns about this and the concerns about this, some of the things that you talked about and the consequences are bleeding into some of the volatility in the stock markets and in the markets in general. And that is something apparently that the president has really loved the fact that for much of his presidency, certainly up until about September, October, the stock market was on a record roll, and he loved to take credit for that. He seems particularly sensitive, though, to the volatility in the markets, and you would think that perhaps that would goad him into perhaps some kind of a compromise.
Well, I think eventually, yes, the accumulation of external circumstances are going to move the president towards a compromise. And he will argue that he fought as hard as he could to satisfy his base, and now, you know, the government must function. That's my guess as to how it works out. But, you know, this is a fellow who is very unconventional in the way he governs. There was a very interesting television interview with Nancy Pelosi's daughter, the filmmaker Alexandra Pelosi, and she was saying, you know, the Washington rule book is you need to make friends in order to work with other people and get something done. Right. And this president has burned up, torched that rule book.
Right. And, but you know, and at each kind of turn, he somehow has, you know, survived. I mean, he you know, really, in a lot of ways, each time, and this has gone on, you obviously have done a lot of research into, you know, Donald Trump, but at every turn going back to the campaign where he seemed like he was done, or he seemed like he just made this grievous error going back to, I mean, you know, the comments about John McCain not being a hero and all those things, he was continuously able to survive.
Right. But I think the key point here is empirical consequences, what really happens to people. And a couple things. First of all, being president puts you in front and center for a lot of citizens. And his standard operating procedure, you know, is very aggressive and very self-promotional. And I think this is a president who's gotten into more people's heads and further into their heads than most presidents do. And that works with some people, but it really repels other people. And I think that's also a problem with governing in Washington.
Right. Is it, and you know, you're somebody who's studied the presidency. I mean, is there any sort of parallel, you know, or historical precedent for the Trump-like presidency, or is this really completely breaking the mold?
Well, no, I think the closest parallel goes way, way back to 1828 and the election of Andrew Jackson. After all, remember, Trump has said that he really admires Jackson. He's put Jackson's portrait in the White House, I think in the Oval Office. Jackson was a very unvarnished fellow who engaged in multiple duels in his life and had a lot of bullets in his body as he governed as president. He was prone to a big temper and to vituperation. That's about as close as we can come to Trump, I think.
All right. Well, it's, and you're right. He is that. That's the portrait he chose for, I think, in the Oval Office to have Andrew Jackson there. Listen, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I do want to ask you about this new dynamic, Democratic, younger, more diverse House, including Representative Ilhan Omar from Minnesota. I want to ask you about the impact of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. But also there was another representative, one of this new group of young representatives, who uttered an obscenity as she talked about trying to or wanting to impeach the president. So I'd like to get your take on that. Let's take a quick break. You are listening to News Talk 830. It's 8:21. Esme Murphy, along with Professor Stephen Scheer. What is your take of this new, young, diverse House and some of these members that seem to be writing their own rule books, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like Ilhan Omar, and like Rashida Tlaib, who was the Michigan representative who uttered a profanity saying she wanted to work on impeaching the president, something that's sort of gone viral. Is this sort of a different group here, and what impact do you think they'll have?
Well, I think it's a problem for Nancy Pelosi, frankly, because what may be emerging in the Democratic caucus in the U.S. House is what has already emerged in the Republican caucus. In the Republican caucus, there's a hard right group that has been consistently a problem for the party leadership, and they're formally organized, the Freedom Caucus, they're called. Jim Jordan is their head. And what we may be seeing now, there is a progressive caucus in the U.S. House of Democrats, and with this differing agenda and differing rhetorical style, you may be getting divisions within the Democratic caucus of the sort we saw in the Republican caucus to produce big problems for party leaders.
And in terms of this, threat to impeach, and obviously this is kind of brewing out there, and with a democratically controlled House, mm-hmm. some of these committees will have subpoena power.
Oh, yes.
Where, and I know you were, a student of history. Where does this really stand right now? And is this something that you think is potentially something that could, in fact, happen?
Well, let's start first of all with subpoenas. Subpoenas will be happening. There'll be a cannonade of subpoenas, and there'll be investigations. Unless there's something dramatic that we don't know about, a lot of these investigations really don't have long-term electoral impacts. Now, as for impeachment, we've already had the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, say that she doesn't believe in pursuing that at this point, whereas some of her progressive members want to impeach Trump now. So there's that sort of division brewing as well. You need a high crime and misdemeanor. It would have to pass through the House Judiciary Committee. Now, it's important to note that Jerry Nadler of Manhattan, who is the Democratic chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has long been an opponent of Trump's in New York regarding development projects going all the way back to the 1980s. So they have known each other, Trump and Nadler, and they have a great dislike for each other. So Nadler has talked about impeachment, but not in an actionable way, at least in the short term. But there is certainly no love lost between Jerry Nadler and Donald Trump.
In terms of the parallels of, the Nixon scandal, obviously President Clinton was impeached. Is there enough there, or is it just a matter of or will another shoe have to drop with the Mueller investigation to really get this off the ground?
I don't think it gets off the ground without the majority party leadership at least facilitating it, and they're not doing that now. It's hands off for them. And I think everyone's waiting to see what Mueller comes up with and whether it can approach the level of a high crime or misdemeanor. I mean, you have to remember, Nixon was engaged in a criminal conspiracy to obstruct justice as president, and that was verified by audio tapes.
There's a lot of evidence. Yeah,
we don't have anything like this yet for Trump.
Well, except that in the indictment of Michael Cohen, one of the indictments of Michael Cohen, there was stated by prosecutors that Michael Cohen acted on the direction of the president or the then candidate Donald Trump for these payments, hush money payments.
The reason you're not hearing much about that is because other candidates in the past have been tried for similar campaign finance uses of campaign money. John Edwards,
yes.
Yeah. And the jury did not convict them.
Right.
So we don't have a record of a convictable crime. Now, what Cohen did was plead guilty to a crime that he could probably have beaten in court because he wanted to get a better sentence. It didn't end up working that way either. So the crime that Cohen pled guilty to has never been litigated in court. When a similar crime was litigated by John Edwards, the jury did not convict. So you see, it's very murky.
Right. And that was actually a striking parallel because it was money that went to his mistress.
Exactly.
His mistress that he had a secret affair with. And there was a child that was born, and for he tried to pass it off as the child of one of his staffers.
Right. So there's all that. Plus, it was explicitly campaign money. And this was Trump's money, but it wasn't explicitly campaign money used in the payoff.
Right. So you don't think – and I've seen a lot of people refer to the Edwards situation. You think that content and that issue in and of itself is not enough, that it doesn't rise to the Nixonian –
Well, no, because level. I think if it did, you would hear a lot of Democrats pressing the issue, and you're not.
Right. In terms of the United States Senate, which obviously is in Republican hands, it sounds like, going back to this issue of the shutdown, it sounds like there are fractures emerging there. I mean, is that enough to push the president over? Or he certainly has been not shy about doing things on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough, do you think, to maybe get him to bend?
Well, the main problem for Republicans who want to buck the president in the Senate is that Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has a strong control over the Senate agenda and what proceeds. And he will certainly be trying to impede any sort of effort of that sort as long as the shutdown is occurring. So, you know, at this point, it's just talk. It's not clear it can be translated into a Senate action that, along with the House, could lead to a confrontation with the president.
But what do you think about, you know, certainly the House candidates that ended up losing their seats in the November election, including Congressman Eric Paulson, tended to be Republicans who weren't openly supportive of the president. In fact, we're often critical of the president. Mm-hmm. And the message there seemed to be, this is Donald Trump's Republican Party, and you better stand in line with Donald Trump. Is there that, I mean, was that, do you think that's a message that came out of this? Or not?
Well, I think within the Republican Party, it's pretty hard to put together an anti-Trump movement. So I think within the Republican Party, what you said is accurate. But within the broader electorate, it's not at all clear that being with Donald Trump is a majority position. And I think a lot of defeated Republicans would agree with that statement. Eric Paulson being one of them.
Right. Well, then let me ask you about Mitt Romney, who is now a senator from Utah, who wrote a scathing op-ed criticizing the character of the president. And the president fired back saying, I won the presidency. You didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he said he won big. Some people pointed out that actually I think Mitt Romney got more votes than the president. But that still doesn't matter. You know, it's Donald Trump won. Mitt Romney didn't. That was definitely a shot across the bow.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think somebody like a Mitt Romney is going to emerge to challenge the president?
No, but what I think Romney is trying to do, and he may be successful in this, is find a way to really affect the behavior of the president. If important Republicans in the Senate and begin to publicly criticize and demand different sorts of behavior, Trump will pay attention to that because he knows that that's an important part of his institutional base that he has to keep on his side. And I think Romney knew that, and I think that's one reason Romney put that out there. He's sort of saying, look, Mr. President, you can't count on us to go to the mat for you when you're acting unreasonably. And I think that'll get Trump's attention over time.
Okay. All right. Well, obviously, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. Well, listen, we do have to take a break. I want to give you some weather. And then when we come back, we want to talk about the incoming governor, the governor-elect, Tim Walz, who will be the governor of the state of Minnesota. He'll be sworn in on Monday, and the new legislature that is coming in, and what might get done or what might not get done at the state capitol. We're chatting with Professor Stephen Scheer. Keep it right here on News Talk 830. We'll come back with some weather. It's 8:36 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College, talking about, shifting gears here, talking about the new governor. Tim Walz will become the governor of Minnesota on Monday. He'll be sworn in. And there is a divided legislature. Of course, the House became a democratically controlled House. The Minnesota Senate is very narrowly a Republican Senate, and I'm talking very narrow. And actually, Steve Scheer, I find this just amazing. This is apparently the only divided legislature in the country.
Yeah, the only divided state legislature.
State legislature. Yeah. That just sort of blows me away.
Yeah. Well, it's a fact. It's a result of the Senate being elected in 4-year terms, so they were not really up. Only one Senate seat was up. Michelle Fischbach's vacated seat this last November. So the Democratic wave of last November does not affect the Senate. The Senate is not up again until 2020.
Right. So what do you think will be, because I mean, these sessions at the Capitol in the past few years have been just marred by, you know, fighting and, you know, even a bill that was, would have put the Minnesota state taxes laws in conformity with the federal law was vetoed by the governor. So now you've got two sets of taxes that I think we talked about this earlier with another guest. It's going to be kind of a mess for a lot of people.
Yep.
What do you think? And the, you know, Governor-elect Walz is talking about some pretty bold initiatives. He's talking about a gas tax. He's talking about legalizing marijuana. What is your take on what lies ahead here at the state legislature?
Well, a couple things. The two things to watch, I think, politically are, first of all, the internal unity of the State House Democrats under Melissa Hortman, the new Speaker of the House. A lot of new suburban members are in, and they are probably more moderate than some of the hardcore progressives. I'm not certain that a really winning issue in the Twin Cities suburb is legal pot, for example. And I think Hortman knows that, and that may produce divisions within her own caucus. And there may be that problem with tax increases as well with the new suburban representative. So you have to watch and see what happens within the House caucus, Democratic caucus. Then the other thing to watch is the very narrow majority caucus by one seat of the Senate Republicans. I'm certain that the governor will be trying to pick off a Republican senator or two for a gas tax increase, for renewing the medical providers tax, which is set to expire, perhaps for legalizing marijuana and for other initiatives, an infrastructure package for roads and bridges. Can any Republicans be picked off? And let me mention a name of one Republican senator who might be available for such persuasion, and that's Jim Abler, a suburban Republican who was one of the override six who overrode Tim Pawlenty's veto of a gas tax increase in 2008, and produced the last time we had a gas tax increase. He has also suggested publicly an alternative way to increase taxes to make up for the expiring medical device or medical providers tax. So Abler may be available for some tax increases, but the problem for someone like Abler is going back to your Republican activists at home and saying, hey, I raised your taxes. Good luck selling that to the partisan faithful.
Right. and that area is the core of Republican strength in the state of Minnesota, certainly the heart of the 6th Congressional District. In terms of, though, you know, Governor-elect Walz, you know, he won decisively, and I've interviewed him, and actually I'll be interviewing him again tomorrow. He really believes that he's got a mandate, and he made it very clear that he was running, you know, on a gas tax. He didn't shy away from that. He really believes that he's got a mandate to do something. I also think that he feels very strongly that he has a mandate to do some kind of gun control legislation.
Yeah. But of course, the question is, what will legislators want to do? Mandates are often overinterpreted by winners, and they find out the hard way that they don't exist, and that may happen to the governor, it may not, but the fact is he doesn't have the votes right now in the state Senate, and Republicans in the state Senate, stung from the last election, are perhaps not as willing to compromise with him as he would wish. I think you can already get a suggestion of that in the public statements of Senate Majority Leader Paul Kozelka, who has basically said no to several of the major initiatives Governor-elect Walz has put forward.
In terms of the personalities, it seems like, you know, a number of the problems that we've had in recent years have resulted in strong, to say the least, personality clashes between the governor and especially, I think, the House Speaker, Kurt Dowd.
Yes.
It just didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also there were problems with the DFL Senate Majority Leader. Do you think that it's going to be different, or that will that sort of thing pop up again?
Well, I think Tim Walz is going to put a premium on developing working relationships to the extent that he can with these other leaders. You know, Governor Dayton basically withdrew from conflict rather than trying to work out differences, particularly late in his second term. And Walz, as a new governor, with an agenda and an ambitious vision for the state, will want to try and accomplish things and be much more, I think, engaged than Governor Dayton was at the end of his second term.
Right. And in terms of that's certainly what, you know, Governor-elect Tim Walz has said that he wants to do as well. Mm-hmm. It will be interesting, though, you know, just to see how fragile that coalition will be, or how fragile that majority is in the Senate. And they're all facing election here in a couple of years.
Right.
And they've got to be a little nervous right now.
Right. Well, and of course, this is a budget session, and you're talking about over $50 billion in spending. And so even though we have a surplus of $1.5 billion, that's less than 2% of the state budget, and most of that will be eaten up by inflation in any event. How will the money be allocated in the governor's plan? We'll find that out in February. It's a huge agenda item to work out. And the reason it's so complex right now, Esme, is that he has made so many promises about so many areas, you know, more education spending, more health spending, more infrastructure spending, et cetera, et cetera. Where's the revenue come from, and how do you propose to increase spending and still balance the budget? It really requires him to get very serious about spending priorities, and we just don't know what those decisions are going to be yet.
And you know, at the end of the day, I mean, the gas tax proposal, what he's talking about is about $1 billion he wants to raise, and that's factored – when you factor that out, it's about a 10-cent increase.
Yeah.
And that's – but that, again, it's something that he did campaign on, and people knew that he advocated that, and he did have a solid win. It's interesting, though, that you what you said about people overplaying their view of consensus.
Tim Walz won statewide, and I'm not – but, you know, the polling that I saw from Survey USA and KSTP that fall showed the gas tax was unpopular.
Right.
So you can win with an unpopular position that people are not paying careful attention to. But then when you put that to the top of the agenda, the whole politics of the situation changes, particularly when you have new suburban members elected in the House whose constituents are driving every day and are quite aware of the price of gasoline.
There you go. All right. Well, listen, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to get your take on Mark Dayton's legacy, governor, obviously, for 8 years. So we're talking about that next on News Talk 830. But first, let's take a quick break. All right. It's 8:49 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor Stephen Scheer. Your thoughts on Mark Dayton's legacy?
Well, I would say that one area where he had a big impact was in education policy.
Absolutely.
And that his main impact in terms of public policy occurred after the election of a Democratic legislature in 2012. He was able to, in 2013, get all-day kindergarten funded across the state. That was a big thing. And also expanded pre-K programs to the point where thousands of students are now taking pre-K in a way that they didn't before. So I think there's that legislatively. Also, during that time, the state was a pioneer in legalizing gay marriage, and I think he'll look back on that as being a pioneer in that regard. The other thing to note that often goes unremarked about a governor, and particularly a two-term governor, is the way you can reshape the state judiciary and the state Supreme Court with your appointments. And he's been able to move it in a more liberal and progressive direction in a way that will last for a considerable period of time. And that trend will also continue, I think, under the next governor, Tim Walz.
Right. And in terms of two-term governors, I mean, Minnesota does have a history of having two-term governors, with the exception, really, I guess, most recently of Jesse Ventura. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if Tim Walz can, you know, add to that, continue that tradition. And certainly, I mean, what we saw in this election is once again, in a state that really has Donald Trump nearly won, still nobody getting elected to a statewide office as a Republican. Since Tim Pawlenty in 2006, which is just, it's extraordinary to me.
It's 12 years now, and I think it just reflects the fact that the state party is not competitive statewide in the candidates they select, in the resources they can devote to those candidates, and in the agendas that they are presenting to the Minnesota public. All three problems are significant problems, and they all beset the Republican Party in the state right now. And it also does not look like there's an immediate turnaround in the offing. So if I were Tim Walz, I would consider the possibility of 8 years to be a good possibility.
Yes, certainly. And I'm sure he's looking at that. But I agree with you. I do think that the number one legacy, I think, is that all-day kindergarten bill. And you know, it's remarkable during the debate over that how controversial it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then the next year when it became law, I think 92% or 5%, I mean, it was some astronomical figure of the percentage of families that were taking advantage of it.
Right.
Was so overwhelmingly high. And you know, I've actually done, it's been a couple of years, but I should revisit this story, you know, talking to, I did a story visiting first grade teachers after this had been in place for, I think, about a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the contrast was startling.
Yeah.
To have a group of kids that had all gone through all day kindergarten. It's still voluntary, but they said, you know, it really, they were better prepared for first grade.
Right. As you said, it's voluntary, but just about everybody's volunteering their kids for it. And we'll see over the long term how this affects student performance and also educational disparities in the state, which remain very problematic and among the worst in the nation. So there's a lot of work yet to be done on this. But now that it's passed, Esme, I think it's here to stay.
Oh, absolutely. And I do think that eventually, you know, Dayton was frustrated in getting a universal pre-K law passed. That's something he didn't quite achieve. But as you said, he certainly, the access and expansion of access to to pre-K is something that is part of his legacy as well. I just see that as happening eventually. I don't know if it's...
And Tim Walz is for that. But again, the question, the big question with this budget is, what are your top priorities? Because that's where you have to put the money. And what are you going to wait on and hope to spend on later? And we just don't know that yet.
Right. And you know, I think that there does seem to be some kind of consensus for some kind of major allocation for infrastructure.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think did in, you know, over in Wisconsin. I think that was a factor in the governor's race there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it'll be interesting to see that as well. And I think your judiciary points are really well taken, because that's something that, you know, you think about it so much at the federal level with the president's appointments, which really will last for generations,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's something that obviously is going to have an impact here as well. But I do agree with you. I think that those are some of his definite legacies. And certainly the one on education is enormous. It's difficult to understand why that was controversial now when you see how popular it is and how people
exactly.
have taken advantage of it. Well, listen, Professor Stephen Scherr, I just want to thank you so much for joining me this hour. Always a pleasure.
Well, there's a lot happening right now.
I know. There certainly is. All right. Well, take care. Thank you so much again.
Bye-bye.
All right. Absolutely. That's Professor Stephen Scherr of Carleton College. Always great to talk to him. Well, folks, winding down here, I do want to give a shout out to the producers of this show, David Josephson, organizing the lineup here, even stepping in when somebody was not able to make it. So I appreciate David always doing a great job. And then also producers Jonathan Lowe and Shaletta Brundage. Great to be back and see everybody again. You know, I mean, I feel like it's been weeks and weeks and weeks because it has been weeks and weeks and weeks. Anyway, so it's great to be back. Great to be back with everyone here on News Radio 830 WCCO. And also want to invite you to tune in to WCCO TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. Mike Augustinak will be there. A volatile week in weather, obviously super mild, but the forecast calling for some messy stuff tomorrow night, mixed precip, snow, possibly rain, and then in the middle of the week, man, very, very cold. So Mike will have the update. And then at 10:30 a.m., I'll be joined by two very prominent members of the Minnesota congressional delegations, two of the more senior members, Democrat Betty McCollum and also Republican Tom Emmer, to get the latest on this government shutdown. We'll need to figure out where the talks are. I know they're meeting in Washington. Perhaps those two will have insight. So keep it here, folks. News Talk 830 WCCO.